Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
Hello, you're watching Give the People What They Want. Let me fix my camera first. Today is the 29th of March, a very important day globally, especially for people who are struggling in solidarity with the people of Palestine. Today is Land Day. We'll come to that a bit later. Land Day, especially important this year, considering the suffering the Palestinians are undergoing, but also the resistance they're mounting to the occupation, to the genocidal acts of Israel, resistance of which has a long tradition and which we've seen intensified over the course of the past few months. So that's today, the 29th of March. And we'll start, of course, with what has been happening in Palestine over the past few days. This has been a very eventful week, a lot of developments. The most important thing, I think, to note, or not the most important thing, but one definite important thing that took place on Monday was the ceasefire resolution passed by the United Nations Security Council. Now, it has to be remembered that on three occasions earlier, the United States vetoed the call for an immediate ceasefire. Although it was very clear that the bulk of global opinion was in support of a ceasefire, although it is very clear that the bulk of domestic opinion in the United States was in support of a ceasefire, nonetheless, the U.S. government time and again repeatedly vetoing these calls for a ceasefire. But on Monday, it was forced to abstain. Even now, it did not support this call. It abstained. It's a very important note. And that's very clearly because of the fact that the sheer number of protests and the brazenness with which Israel has been carrying out these attacks has, I think, forced the Biden administration to sort of, retreat in a way. It has forced the Biden administration to issue a, to at least abstain or give the impression that it is abstaining when it comes to this vote. And the vote, of course, passed. 14, all the other 14 countries supported, including very traditional allies of Israel, such as the United Kingdom, all of them supporting this resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. The U.S. abstained. And finally, the UN Security Council acting on finally the UN Security Council responding to this war, which has been going on for so many months with this brutal attack. The UN Security Council finally has a position. But what was Israel's response? And as you can guess, it continues with its attacks. Every day people are dying. And not only is it attacking inside Gaza, it is continuing with its atrocities in the West Bank. It also attacked Lebanon. It also attacked Syria. In fact, reports say that the attacks on Syria were carried out in connivance with the United States. The U.S. is, of course, denied it. But Israel very clearly is in no mood to heed the ceasefire. So what has happened right now is that you finally have the United Nations Security Council, after the General Assembly, after so many international bodies, after rights organizations, after local, regional bodies, all of them calling for a ceasefire. You have the UNSC also doing so. And Israel, of course, following its very traditional path and refusing to do so. And, this, I think, by now, this demonstrates, this reiterates the point we've all been saying for all these months, that Israel clearly behaves as though it has the kind of impunity that to reject all kinds of international pressure. And the reason it has that impunity is the fact that, despite the fact that there is a demand for a ceasefire, there is no penal action yet for disobeying it. And the important thing to note is that if Israel does not obey this resolution, now the UN Security Council will have an opportunity, supposedly at some point, to consider this aspect that it does not obey the resolution. What then will the United States do is really the question. Will the United States then once again, muddy the waters as it has been doing all this while? Will it refuse to take a stand? Will it veto any kind of statement critical of Israel or any kind of action critical of Israel? All that is possible as per UN laws, because if a UN Security Council resolution is violated, the Security Council has a variety of options on what to do. But it has to pass those options, it has to vote on those options. And that is where I fear the US will actually play its true cards, so to speak. So very important, very important resolution that we saw at this point of time, and it's definitely not going to be heeded by Israel. It's very clear. On the other hand, across the Arab world, across West Asia, across North Africa, we have seen massive protests taking place. Jordan is especially important where these protests are taking place. Three key countries: Jordan, Morocco, and Egypt, all of whom have signed deals recognizing and normalizing ties with Israel. Egypt, of course, was the first. Jordan was the second in the 90s. and Morocco recently as part of the Abraham Accords. All of these countries did sign ties normalizing relationships with Israel. All of them have very strong diplomatic relations with Israel. We know that Egypt also enforces the siege on Gaza, which is a huge reason for the kind of suffering the Palestinian people are facing. So it's interesting that the protests are taking place in these countries. There are thousands taking to the streets, apparently, in many cities in these countries, demanding not only an immediate ceasefire as per the resolution, also demanding the termination of diplomatic ties with Israel. I believe in Jordan, there have been multiple attempts to storm the Israeli embassy. Morocco, a country where political repression is rife, it is very significant to note that despite that, there have been massive protests, pro-Palestinian protests taking place in a country like Morocco. And this really, you know, it's really a sign to the rulers of these countries that what is the position that they're going to take, very important for them as well. So a lot happening. Like I said, we of course have the International Court of Justice, which earlier also, you know, put out quite a strong ruling against Israel. Now, once again, is probably quite a unique instance, once again passing an order ordering that Israel, you know, take steps to ensure humanitarian aid be delivered because of the threat of famine. I think the latest numbers are that 31 people, including 27 children, have died of starvation in 2024. There's no other word to describe it. It's horrendous at multiple levels, the fact that an occupation force is starving children to death, and 27 children have died. And this is possibly most likely an instance of undercounting, because there are many more children. And we have, on People's Dispatch, we have our colleagues at People's Health Dispatch who every week have been chronicling the impact of this food, the starvation. And it's important to remember, it's not only about the deaths. The deaths are the most horrendous aspect, but we are seeing an entire generation, who they're going to suffer for their entire lifetimes because of the kind of lack of food, the kind of struggle that the situation they're facing right now. So the ICJ has once again ordered Israel to take action to address this issue. That's also because of the fact that over the months, and even especially after the last ICJ verdict in January, aid delivery has actually come down. It has decreased. The number of trucks has decreased substantially. The number of trucks that are relief trucks that are being allowed into Gaza, which means those delivering relief have to make choices between, for instance, say food and essential medical equipment, all kinds of very hard choices they've had to make. And this is what is causing this kind of a famine situation, And we also, of course, have Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur, who released a report which says that there are at least three counts by which Israel is conducting genocide in Gaza. Francesca Albanese is a very important voice because of the fact that she has consistently spoken out, challenged some of these media narratives that have been going on for quite a long time. And so it's important to read that report. It's important to see what she's been saying for quite a long time. The fact, and I think across Gaza, aid agencies have been consistently chronicling in the fact that there is a very deliberate attempt to attack an entire population, to target an entire population. Israel claims that this is not about Hamas, but then what explains the number? Massive, thousands of women and children who are being killed, children and women being killed on almost a daily basis. What explains that? So, you know, under three counts, Francesca Albanese has definitely indicted Israel for genocide. I would urge you to read that report. It's a very straightforward title. It's called Anatomy of a Genocide, as clear as it can be. And that is, today where we are at. A very difficult situation for the people of Gaza, but also a moment of struggle. Globally, the struggle is taking place, and that situation, land day, is very significant.
Yeah, that's exactly right. March 30th marks just about 47 years since March 30th, 1976, which was a massive protest that took place in Palestine against the Israeli occupation. This protest was met with mass repression. Several people were killed, hundreds injured. And since then, and this was a protest about land, about Israel continuing to illegally seize land, to occupy more land, which hasn't stopped. And so every single year on March 30th, the people across Palestine and the diaspora and solidarity groups commemorate this day, remembering the continued struggle for land against oppression, against the repressive forces of the Israeli occupation, and to continue that struggle. Of course, this year, Land Day holds specific importance, just given the fact that Israel, of course, is continuing to carry out a genocide in Gaza. And as many people have pointed out, this is about control of the land. We've seen that throughout these 6 months of the genocide, Israel has actually taken control over more territory within Gaza. And one of the key demands actually of the resistance with regards to the negotiations, which is something that Israel has actually refused to accept and has classified as a ridiculous demand, is the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. We know that, of course, when the establishment of the State of Israel, which is this illegal colonial project that happens in that moment in 1948, the land that is allocated for a Palestinian state is vastly different than what it looks like today. Of course, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, the growth of settlements and of continued seizure of land by Israel through violent means has continued to today. And so when we talk about, this continued struggle for land and the continued struggle for the Palestinian state, Land Day is really at the heart of this, because people have continued to fight against this narrative that, Israel just wants two states and there's land for the Palestinians, there's land for Israel. This is, of course, a fallacy. And if there's, of course, this famous graphic that always circulates that shows 1948 to the present, and you just see the continued seizure of land by Israel. And throughout this genocidal war on Gaza, actually many Israeli authorities have made this very clear that really it's not about having two states. It's not about having, sovereign land for Palestinians and, sovereign land for Israel, which again is even itself is a premise that's questioned by many. Why can you displace people to create the state? But even under their own premise of the two-state solution, etc., they've said throughout this time that Gaza shouldn't exist, that it should be administered by Israel. We saw the statements by Jared Kushner, of course, saying that they should just seize all this, push Palestinians into the Al-Nakab or Negev desert, that this area, this waterfront area, should be taken by Israel. This is the true intentions of the Zionist project. And so on Land Day, it's another moment to commemorate the struggle for land as part and parcel of the struggle for Palestinian liberation. And again, as you mentioned, Prashant, it is a day of international solidarity and struggle. So I know we're going to see protests across the Arab world. As you mentioned, those struggles which are taking place in North Africa and West Asia are going to intensify. People are fed up with the lack of their government's action on this, the complicity of their governments in furthering the genocide. We're going to see protests happening across Europe, where, again, there's a large diaspora population of Palestinians and of people from across, West Asia. We're also going to see in North America, huge mobilizations are expected in the major cities. So it's going to be, another moment where people are going to take the streets to criticize their government's inaction, and in many cases, complicity in arming, in giving political cover for Israel, in continuing to kind of give this carte blanche to to all of the crimes that are committed. Just to mention that last night, the three genocidaires in chief, Obama, Bill Clinton, and Joe Biden, actually gathered in New York City thinking they could actually have some multi-million dollar fundraiser without any problems facing them. Of course, these three presidents, Democratic presidents, have actually overseen so many different genocidal wars, including several different attacks on Gaza that they have supported. They were, of course, met with disruptions at every single turn, outside and inside their fundraisers. So the pressure continues. People are seeing that the U.S. is caving to these protests, but it's not enough, because as you said before, when it comes to the UNSC actually enforcing the ceasefire resolution, that's probably where the U.S. is going to exercise its muscle and block anything from actually concretely taking place.
Right, absolutely, Zoe. And we'll be tracking that very closely, as we have been doing all these weeks and months. So do keep visiting People's Dispatch, do keep watching our shows where on a daily basis we analyze many of these issues. This is, of course, Give the People What They Want, your weekly news digest, your weekly news show brought to you by People's Dispatch. That's Zoe and I. And Globetrotter, Vijay is busy doing on reporting assignment, so he's not joining us this week, but he will be there with us next week. And we are moving from Palestine, the global struggle around Palestine, to an important election story, which has this time to do with Senegal now. We have talked about Senegal in the past on this show. President Macky Sall, right now, former President Macky Sall, very unpopular with his people because, among other things, he tried to extend his term in power. His term was supposed to end this year, early this year. He tried to extend that. There were massive protests, and there have been massive protests against any attempt by him to do so all this while. And finally, so Senegal, he was forced to hold an election. He didn't want to hold that election that took place towards the end of March, but he was forced to hold that election. And the opposition leader, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, has become the new president of Senegal. Macky Sall's prime minister, who was the main candidate against Faye, has conceded defeat. So now Faye is going to become the president of Senegal. And this is quite a remarkable moment for this country, because Macky Sall, seen very strongly as a puppet of the French, seen as a key person who implemented French agenda in that whole region. And we've talked about how an entire region has been convulsed by a series of anti-imperialist protests, anti-French protests specifically. And now Faye himself is part of a movement led by a very charismatic leader called Ousmane Sonko, who founded this party called PASTEF. And Sonko was initially supposed to contest these elections, but you know, he was disqualified. Faye himself was imprisoned for a while, but he was not disqualified and was able to contest this election and won quite decisively. There was no need for a second round of elections because he won over 50% of the vote. So what does Faye say? So a lot of Faye's the pronouncements that he's made are quite interesting. For global viewers, maybe one of the most interesting ones is his suggestion that Senegal might go for some kind of currency reform, which could even, going away from the CFA franc. You should check out articles on People's Dispatch regarding the CFA franc, how it is used as a tool to bind the economies of many African countries to the French economy and giving France a huge amount of leverage on the economic decisions of these countries. One thing Faye has talked about is the possibility of, reconsidering this kind of control. He's talked about renegotiating a lot of agreements, including economic partnership agreements with the European Union. There's been a lot of criticism in these, in Senegal inside about some of these agreements. He's talked about renegotiating agreements such as those in the mining sector, in the energy sector. He's talked about employment, all of these very, important issues in a country where the young number of young people, the youth population is very high, unemployment is a major issue. And clearly Faye did strike some kind of a chord with the people by pushing these issues, which Macky Sall and his government have been all these years been completely ignoring. Instead, they have been repressing any kind of protests to do, and they've been repressing protests, they've been arresting critics who have raised these kind of issues. So a very, interesting moment here. If you consider what has been happening in all the countries in West Africa, in Mali, in Burkina Faso, in Niger, and now you have Senegal, which was one of the pillars, so to speak, of the French influence in that region also falling. Now, of course, it's too early to say if, Faye is going to take an explicitly anti-French position like some of the leaders in these countries. It might be a far more moderate kind of a position. But nonetheless, it's his victory at this point is interesting. And if he starts following through on some of these policy prescriptions, if he starts following through, if he's able to beat the resistance from some of these entrenched forces, both within domestically and abroad, it could mean a drastic shift in that entire region as a whole. So very, very interesting times for West Africa. Of course, Faye's in government, but there are also social movements across the region which are making very radical calls for reform in the financial sector, like we talked about, in the social sector, in terms of the military, in all these areas. making very radical demands. So very interesting times for West Africa as a whole, and we'll be very closely tracking what happens.
Well, we're going to make another jump, this time right on over to South America, where diplomatic tensions have been brewing across the region. Javier Milei, once again, someone we love talking about, because not only is he ridiculous and it feels like it's not possible whatever he's saying and doing, but also just because of the marked shift that it has created in the region. So this week, CNN in Spanish released kind of a preview of an exclusive interview that they did with him, a sit-down interview. They released two clips, which I think is interesting that they specifically released these clips. And in these, the interviewer, the journalist asks Javier Milei, you know, what he thinks about Gustavo Petro and Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And Javier Milei responds saying that, you know, I'm not worried what Andrés Manuel thinks of me. He's ignorant. And if he criticizes me, then it's a compliment. He later goes on to say that Gustavo Petro, you know, what can you expect of someone who's a terrorist assassin? So, you know, these are words that are not commonly heard by heads of states talking about other heads of states, let alone, you know, anyone. There's sort of a perhaps unspoken rule of decorum and of mutual respect amongst leaders that Javier Milei has essentially thrown out the window. This is not a surprise given the way that he talks about his own people and the way that he kind of wields this hyper-violent, explosive language against his political opponents, the way he talks about the left, and he talked about the left throughout his campaign. But it's one thing to say it about within your own country, and it's another thing to say it about leaders of sovereign nations. And so in response to these comments, the Foreign Ministry of Colombia announced that they were expelling Argentine diplomats from the embassy. Andrés Manuel has also released a statement saying that, again, it's no surprise that these sort of comments would come. He has called Javier Milei what he is, which is a fascist conservative. And both of them have inevitably expressed solidarity with the Argentinian people, who they understand as, of course, not responsible for these comments, but similarly suffering under Javier Milei's rule and his, you know, complete utter disregard for his own people. And again, these comments that he makes against Petro and Andrés Manuel are sort of reflections of the kind of discourse and dialogue that he's been promoting throughout his few months as president. And what's interesting to point out is that Milei came in with this extremely anti-integrationist position. We know that Argentina has been one of the historic leaders of Latin American integration for the past two decades. Néstor Kirchner, Cristina de Kirchner, they were fundamental parts of creating bodies like UNASUR, like CELAC, you know, and really promoting these spaces where leaders in the region can actually work together to create common proposals to their common problems. When Lula was elected, he had a very, very close relationship with Alberto Fernandez. They had common proposals of this, you know, deeply intertwined economic zone, which is Argentina and Brazil. Javier Milei had said defiantly that he does not do business with communists, that he was going to break off all trade with Brazil, with China. He was going to leave all of the spaces of regional integration, which in some senses he has actually fulfilled some of these promises. Others are economically impossible. I think he realized it would be suicide, like many of the policies that he's proposed. But nonetheless, these latest comments, these explosive comments that he made in this sit-down interview, have provoked kind of a new mood within the region. There was this year, perhaps, when all of these different progressive and left-leaning governments coincided. There seemed to be this kind of positive shift towards, again, reactivating CELAC as the counter proposal to the Organization of American States, exploring new ways to actually work together within the region. And these continue because, again, currently Milei is sort of an outlier. He is isolated within the region. But again, it does speak to the fragility of these spaces, given the fact that a lot of the leaders are elected, of course, all of them in most of them in these kind of liberal bourgeois democratic systems, where again, money and the power of, you know, longtime economic interests and political rulers really rules. But again, we're going to see what happens going forward. Will Colombia rekindle the ties with Argentina? Or is this a temporary thing? How will this really impact in the political scene in the region? Milei has, importantly for viewers to know, he has pledged allegiance to the United States in many different occasions, saying that, you know, why would he do business? Why would he work with people in the region who are just leftist criminals? The important thing is to have a good relationship with the United States. This is, again, in complete contradiction to kind of the independent and Latin America forward approach of his predecessors. So, you know, once again, Milei is making these comments, but they do have concrete impacts. Andrés Manuel has kind of brushed it off and said, you know, I'm not worried about this kind of crazed man. And many leaders in the region have actually expressed solidarity with both of the rulers. Alberto Fernández, former president, released a statement saying that he completely repudiates this. He also had a very strong relationship with Gustavo Petro. So, you know, important development in the region. We'll see how it actually shakes out in the political and economic realm going forward and how Milei continues to act in these regional spaces.
Right, Zoe. And finally, our final story is an issue we have been tracking for a very long time, for years, in fact, and it is the story of a journalist. It's a story of whistleblower. It's a story of someone who has fought for, fought against imperialism through his work. That's Julian Assange. And there's been a fresh twist in the case of his extradition, which is really by the Royal High Court in the United Kingdom. And they have given a verdict based on, they're given a verdict on the question of whether he can appeal against his extradition. This was considered the last ditch attempt to sort of prevent this extradition. And the fact is, basically, what the court has delivered is quite a problematic verdict in many ways, because it has said that there is a possibility of Assange appealing against his extradition, provided the US and the UK do not give a certain set of assurances. Now, what are these assurances? Basically, the United States has to give the assurance that Assange will be protected, will not be discriminated against because of the fact that he's not an Australian, he's not a US national, and that he will be given his First Amendment rights, and that he will not be given the death penalty. Now, this is a very narrow set of grounds as per which Assange can appeal his extradition. But it's also, the court has refused the possibility of, giving Assange being allowed to bring in fresh evidence, including the fact that US intelligence agencies are at least believed to have plotted to either kidnap him, or there was some discussion about even killing him. All of those aspects, the fact that he could face extreme amounts of, torturous conditions in US prisons, none of that really can be examined again. And in that sense, it's an unfortunate verdict, because it does not really address the question of Assange being a political prisoner. It does not address the question of Assange, being a whistleblower. It does not address the question of the fact that the U.S. government, which basically targeted Assange's life in various ways, is the one giving those assurances whereby it says, it's all going to be fine. And I think Assange's wife Stella pointed out that all the courts are demanding is that the U.S. give an assurance letter saying that it's all okay. And so it has not considered all these aspects. And of course, it has given him that a reprieve of a few weeks in that sense. The U.S. government has until April to sort of give that assurances. There'll be a fresh hearing on the 20th of May if these assurances are given. And so it's up to the U.S. administration. Once again, they have a real challenge, a real question before them. Do they do what is right? Do they recognize the fact that Assange is a journalist, is a publisher? What he was doing was not espionage, because that has been the U.S. charge, that it's an espionage case of espionage. Do they accept that and, let this case be? Or do they continue persecuting him and continue sending out a clear message across the world that this is how we treat those who stand up to us. This is how we treat those who ask questions of us. So very important couple of weeks for Julian Assange. We'll be tracking him closely as well. As all the other stories we have been talking about on this show, it's important to note that many of these stories we talk about on this show regularly are part of our very regular coverage of all these regions, of all these countries, because that is how we sort of build the kind of journalism we're talking about. That is how we try to give the people what they want. So do come back to our show next week, where hopefully Vijay will also be back by then, where we bring you stories from across the world. And until then, stay safe.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall.